I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Lorna Crozier joins me again. She has just published to wide acclaim a new memoir, Through the Garden, A Love Story with Cats. In the book, she recounts the history of her relationship with the writer and poet Patrick Lane, as well as his final years as they dealt with his illness. The book is also about the cats they had in the garden they lovingly cultivated in the 40 years they were together. It's a beautiful book and one that I enjoyed because it gives the reader a sense of their passionate relationship, sometimes tumultuous, but full of beauty, affection, and words. The words they spoke, words unspoken, and the remarkable output both have had as writers. The book is a finalist for the Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize for Nonfiction, and this past Sunday she received the City of Victoria Butler Book Prize for her poetry collection, The House the Spirit Builds. Lorna Crozier is the author of 18 previous books of poetry, receiving the Governor General's Literary Award for Poetry for Inventing the Hawk. Three additional collections were finalists for the same prize. She received the Hubert Evans Award for Creative Nonfiction for her memoir, Small Beneath the Sky, which she was on this program with in 2009. She's an officer of the Order of Canada, and in this province has received the BC Lieutenant Governor's Award for Literary Excellence and the George Woodcock Lifetime Achievement Award. She is Professor Emerita at the University of Victoria. Visit lornacrozier.ca for more. This new book is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Lorna Crozier. Professor Crozier, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. It's great to talk to you again.
It's nice to talk to you, too. I just love this book, and I tweeted as I was reading it that it is a book that I enjoyed reading. It's a book that I didn't think I needed to read.
Oh, now why is that?
There are many moments in the book that are just beautiful. They're beautiful between two people, and I kind of know you, both of you over the have gotten to know both of you over the years, because I've talked to both of you three or four times, I guess, each.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, people know about you and know about your relationship through other things that they've read, through poetry that you've both written about yourselves and each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a marvelous way to look at these 40 years that you spent with one another. I'm wondering, as you were writing the book, I mean, it seems that it was inevitable, because you do mention it in the book, that as Patrick was sick, you were writing parts of it. Is that right?
Yeah. I didn't know what else to do, I guess, to be honest. The first time he was in the hospital was towards the end of 2016, and before he was admitted, he had all these strange symptoms where at one point he couldn't move his neck, and then at another point his whole leg got swollen. Another time his skin was so sensitive I couldn't touch him. Then he had a headache so bad, he said it felt like someone had pulled an electric wire around his forehead, and finally, he was hospitalized, as I said, in 2016, and when he got out, he wasn't better. They just released him because they couldn't figure out what was wrong with him, and they never did in his 3 years of being in the hospital and me having to phone 911 and, you know, all kinds of things. So the first time he was hospitalized, then he got back home, and he was so frail, and I thought, I don't know how I'm going to live with this on a daily basis and still keep my equanimity and still be there 100% for him, as a lover, as a wife, as suddenly a caregiver. And I thought, well, Crozier, the way you've survived tough things in the past is you go into your room and you try to find words for it. So I started to do that, just to really hang on to my sanity.
And what does that do for the grieving process? Because, I mean, I'm sure some or a lot of the book was written after he died. Does writing about it or writing about him, does that help at all? I mean, I'm wondering for someone who doesn't write, if that's
useful
at all.
Most of the book was written when he was still alive, and then I edited it after he died. And if there were gaps, especially in the story about our past lives together, how we met and so on, I fleshed them out or, you know, refined them. But the majority of the book was written when he was alive. I had as kind of, I knew how the book was going to end. It was going to end with the death of our old cat, Pasho, who was 18, maybe 19 when he died. And I knew he was getting feebler and feebler, and I thought, when he's gone, I'll end the book, because he's a character throughout. Yeah. And I realize now he was probably an alter ego for Patrick, but I didn't figure that out at the time of writing. So when Basho died, that was in November, and Patrick was still alive. He was in the hospital at the time, but he got out, he came home, and he died 3 months later. So the book ends with Patrick alive and with both of us with a very frail hope that his seven specialists, that one of them would figure out a treatment that was going to give him a few more years and me a few more years with him. And in terms of what it does for grief, you know, it's I've had a terrible year and a half because I miss him so much. And what I've kind of been thinking is that there should be more than one word for grief. It's become a cliche that the Inuit have about 12 words for snow, and I understand that Thai people have about 7 words for spirit, and we only have one. And I was thinking grief is just not a good enough word to carry all of the emotions that you go through and you lose someone that you care for so deeply, because it has different nuances, different tones as you work through the loss. You know, initially it's just, at least for me, it was complete and total numbness. And I can't remember much of the first 6-7 months. I don't even know who I gave many of his things to. They're gone because I needed to give them to someone. Which son was it who took his watch, you know, which son was it who took one of his drawings? I haven't a clue. And I'm more cogent now, but I'm still kind of stunned around the heart. So there's got to be another word for it.
You talk about what it was like when he was in and out of the hospital. And I drew a parallel to these last 9 months of most of us, I guess, staying at home and you know, not doing much. You lose track of time.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, time becomes a completely, you know, different thing. I was worried when I was writing that I wasn't even going to be able to distinguish what year it was that he was in the hospital, what particular month, because they all sort of became one terrible time. It's like a glass bell drops over them, and you don't hear the clock moving through the hours and one day changing to the next. It's all a singular, scary day. You're kind of trapped in this cage of this moment, and all the fear that goes with it is all you've got. So it was a strange way to live through time, and I became the timekeeper, like the one who had to say, oh gosh, we've got a hematologist appointment today, and tomorrow we have to go to the hospital for another blood test, and the next day you're supposed to see one of your internists. And yet it was all the same terrible day, just kind of stretched thin as a piece of elastic.
And I can only imagine, that's the last 9 months for the rest of us. It's been 9 months and 18 for you.
Yeah, these last 9 months, I mean, I've been lonely, and I've been lonelier than lonely because of COVID, you know, not to whine and feel sorry for myself, because as one of my friends said, Patrick left me in a beautiful place. And so I have the garden that he built and nurtured. He was the gardener. I was the gardening assistant. So I don't know what I'm doing half the time. But the garden is very demanding, and I can just step outside the sliding glass door of my office, and I'm on a deck that overlooks the pond, and I have to feed the fish, and I have to feed the turtles, and I have to deadhead, and I have to say to someone, how far down do I cut this plant, and when do I do it? But I can step outside into a place of beauty where he touched every stone, and where he made every plant flourish. So he's certainly present around me.
There's a moment in the book where he's in the hospital and you come home, and you decide to pick up one of his poetry collections, and you said you were just looking for some wisdom or comfort, even a sign from him. And I guess it's the same for the garden, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely is. Sometimes it feels overwhelming, mm-hmm. not only in terms of its demands, and I've had to hire help because I don't have either the physical ability or the expertise to carry on my own, but sometimes it's the sense of him here is overwhelming in a good way, but also in a way that kind of makes me fall into sorrow again.
Mm. You have one cat still, Pochu.
Yes.
Does Pochu miss Patrick?
You know, after he died, it was so strange. I would be sitting outside, and I would have fed her, and she'd come to me and make this little funny squeaky noise she makes. And I'd say, "What do you want? What is it?" And she would literally lead me into the house. I would follow her into our bedroom, and I'd say, "Do you want to lie down with me?" And I'd get onto our bed, and she'd jump up with me and purr and cuddle. It was like she was saying, "Lorna, you have to take a nap now." So she was my nap organizer. I did a lot of sleeping that first year. I just couldn't seem to get through the day without disappearing for a while. And Poe started to take care of me, and I couldn't help but think that she got a message from someone. And yeah. Who could be that messenger except Patrick saying, "Take care of Lorna, Poe. I'm gone now." And she has. I still have to be careful with her. I still read her body language.
Yeah.
The other day I tried to remove a mat from near her back end, and I got a bite and a scratch, but I got the mat. So yeah. We have a bit of a wrestle, a tussle sometimes, but she's become a much more affectionate cat because I think she knows we're alone.
Mm-hmm. He was so, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the cats are such a are characters in the book, essentially.
Yeah.
They're the cats and then you and Patrick, I guess.
Yeah.
He was so, I don't know how to put it, not just cats, but other animals. He was so gentle. And
yes.
I guess that's part of what made him attractive to a lot of people. That was part of his charisma, his charm.
Yeah, I like that you say that, Joe. I mean, if you just read the work, you might think this is a real tough son of a bitch, you
yeah.
know,
the
working class poems being
sure.
in the mill. But a good reader sees the tenderness under that. He was a man who refused to turn his eyes away from suffering, and whether it was the suffering of the working class men and women that he spent his young adult life with, or whether it was the suffering of animals, he just refused to close his eyes to that. He had to find a way to speak it as a way of acknowledging them, and I think of getting other humans to acknowledge it as well and say, "We won't do this anymore." But in our lives together, what I saw mostly was his tenderness and gentleness and his care. I know that with all of these wildfires we've got going now
mm-hmm.
in the West, that Patrick's thing to me, what he would have said to me, which he said when fires were burning in BC and Alberta, "Why does no one mention the animals, Lorna?
Mm-hmm.
Why does no one mention all the birds that are exploding from the trees? You know, I'm so tired of hearing that humans have been driven from their homes. Sure, that matters, but what about all the wildlife?"
There's a beautiful story in the book, funny as well, that you guys were going somewhere, an appointment, and he insists on you driving back because there was, I guess, a spider on the car?
Yeah. He has a lovely passage in his memoir, There is a Season, where he says he judges his friends by how they treat spiders.
Mm.
And he would just be abhorred by anyone who saw a spider and stomped on it or smashed it with a piece of paper. He adored those creatures, and he'd actually drop flies into the female spider's web. If he saw there weren't a lot of flies there, he would try to catch one live with his hand and throw it into the web so the mother spider would be satiated. So I've inherited that. For some reason, I'm getting a lot of spiders in my bathtub, and I make sure I get a piece of paper and get them on the paper and carry them outside. I would never think of killing them because Patrick would be outraged with me.
Yeah, I always assume that, I mean, I've gone through life with the assumption that it's a good thing to think that every spider you encounter is probably deadly. but after reading the book, I do think, you know, I mean, the ones that we see in our house especially, I mean,
they're not deadly at all. No, and they're such fascinating creatures. Just do a little bit of research on them, and you'll start to fall in love with them, I think.
Yeah. And then, the ones I see here in my basement where my books are, where they usually...
None of them are tarantulas or black widows. So you're going to be okay. And just think, they're keeping little bugs from your book.
Even
a bookworm there. Yeah. They're eating the bookworm before it can eat your book.
Silverfish especially, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I was reading the book and you know, you see just the difficulty physically that he was going through.
Yeah.
You title some of the chapters with dates, which I thought was helpful, because I remember I talked to him in June of 2018, and I was surprised that it was in the middle of all of this.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember talking to him, and you know, he mentioned that he'd just come out of the hospital, you know, a couple weeks before. Yet, it was like talking to him, as I did for, you know, over the last 10 years, say.
Well, you know, it's amazing. He was determined to keep on going, and evidence of that is that, about a month before he died, he gave me a file full of new poems that he'd been working on his last year, and he asked me to edit them and said, I think I've got a book here. I really would like your opinion. So I went through them, as we used to do for each other, line by line, and said, yes, nope, love this, don't like this. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have time to go back into them. Before he died, he didn't have time to do any revisions. So what I was working on the last 8 months or so was those poems. And I did edit them with great trepidation. Mm-hmm. Because he wasn't here to say, no, Lorna, you can't take that line out. I insisted be left in. I made literary judgments without him vetoing them and sent them off to Douglas and McIntyre Harbor, and the book's coming out in a year or so. It's going to be called The Quiet in Me. But I was so moved when I went back into those poems, because in spite of him being what turned out to be deathly ill, mm-hmm. he still wanted to write. He had a third novel he was working on, and I haven't had the courage yet to draw that file from his computer and look at it and see whether there are some things that can stand alone, because I wouldn't dare try to complete a novel that he'd started writing. But you know, when you're a writer, when you dedicate yourself to being a writer, you never stop until you stop breathing. And that was certainly his case.
I mentioned the moment in the book where you look at one of his collections for something. I mean, when you read those poems today, those lost poems, if you will, are there things that he's telling you? Are there signs even?
Yeah, most definitely. One of the poems near the end talks about him seeing himself as a little boy, can you get teary, and saying, you know, you're going to live a life and it's going to be full of hardness and sorrow, but you're going to be okay. He says it more poetically, but mm-hmm. it's like he was saying goodbye to himself.
Yeah. I mean, I can't wait to read that book. You say it's going to be out in a year from now?
Yeah, I think a year and a half from now with Harbor.
You mentioned his memoir a moment ago. And I guess for people listening to us, you know, if they're at all interested in him now, since we've been talking about him the last few minutes,
mm-hmm.
That's a good place to start, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
You have marvelous poetry collections over the years, but that memoir itself, I mean, he was brutally honest with himself in that, wasn't he?
I was so proud of him when he wrote that. You know, as you know, he wrote it when he got out of treatment for alcoholism. And he got out in December, and that January, he decided to write about what it was like to come back into the world as a sober man when he'd been a heavy drinker for some 40 years or so, about his reentry, his almost being born again into a new body that felt differently than it had before. And he wrote about his past. It was brutally honest and courageous, and many people have said over the years, and a lot are saying to me now, that it's really become a Canadian classic, that it's the kind of book that will continue to have appeal. And I know it made a huge difference to people, many people who spoke to us at readings about their own lives of addiction or a family member who was either involved with drugs or alcohol or whatever, how much reading that book had meant to them and given them courage to live a fuller life, as Patrick did.
There's also a moment in the book where you, in your book, where I should rephrase that. As I was reading the book, there are many personal things that you write yourself in the book. A lot of things that I would say, you know, I wouldn't write about, even. You told Marsha Lederman in the Globe and Mail that there are parts in the book that you wouldn't want to repeat out loud again. And I'm wondering, why write them out in the first place?
Well, you know, the parts I wouldn't repeat are not the parts where I did anything that was outrageous or shameful or whatever, and I certainly have done outrageous, shameful things. The parts I couldn't read out loud, I could not read about Basho's death, for instance, the chapter about that. I couldn't read some of the sections about Patrick's illness to a live audience.
Yeah.
My voice would break. But that's all. I have always been a writer, as I think Patrick was too, but I can only speak for myself now. I've always been a writer that thinks that those things that shame us, those things that we've kept secret, are often the things we should try to articulate and get out into the world, because I think every feeling we have, everything we've done, is part of our being human. And I think we feel less alone and make people themselves feel less alone when they hear about some of the darker sides of our lives.
It just seems like, as I'm reading the book, and you know, I've talked to you for your first memoir about growing up in Saskatchewan and other work since, there's nothing that one couldn't ask you about, say.
Yeah, I may not answer
every
question, or I might skirt it. There actually are some things, Joe, but I guess I'm the kind of writer that uses my biography, my autobiography, I use it as material, and not in a therapeutic lying on the psychiatrist's couch way. I'm not interested in writing as therapy. I'm interested in writing as art. And it's a huge challenge sometimes to find a way to turn what is raw and painful into art. But if I can't do it, then I wouldn't publish it. If it was moans and sighs and whatever, I would just shove it in a drawer. I would cut it out. So I hope none of that made it into the book. I really believe that what I'm involved in is an aesthetic challenge, not a personal challenge, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. What is? There's another beautiful moment in the book where you talk about, you'd written a poem about someone you knew and a mask and the death of their child. And you were reading the poem out loud at a reading. Remember those?
yeah, I do.
And there's someone in the audience who leaves, but then comes back later to talk to you as you were signing books, and mentions just how moved and how they connected to it. One particular part of the poem, which you write, you made up. What is that like? Because I'm sure your work over the years has touched many people in similar ways. What is it like? What is it like to hear that?
It's very affirmative. It sort of sends a shock through your system, and you know it reminds me. Like, I don't want to sound, you know, heebie-jeebie, artsy-fartsy, but I think the poem always knows more than the poet. And certainly when I write a poem, as when I wrote this book, I start somewhere and I just go with it and get in connection, connect with, if we want to call it the subconscious, whatever, but particularly in a poem, I write the poem until I reach the end, and I don't know what the end's going to be. I don't know where I'm going to go after the initial line. I just have to jump on the cart and go downhill with the poem until I get to where it wants to lead me. And so when someone says, I too put the mask over, my son's mask over my face and lay on the bed, that's the part I had moved, I'd made up, what my friend did with her husband's radiation mask. It's just, wow, I'm glad I went there. I'm glad the poem took me there, because it can speak to that motivation in someone else.
There are also some inexplicable moments, not only in your book, but in your life. I mean, like that time you killed the fish.
Yeah.
Which people should read, because I can't do justice to telling, repeating the story here.
And we have to say that I did not deliberately kill the fish. I was trying to kill a human being who was sitting in front of an aquarium full of fish. The fish were weaker than she was. Yeah. And don't you think she deserved it after my explanation?
Oh, sure. Absolutely, yeah. You talk about when Carol Shields died, and you found out about that in the moments afterwards, which I thought was beautiful and eerie at the same time. When Patrick was alive, did you guys have a talk or talk over the years about what happens when one dies?
Yeah, which is why I knew where to put his ashes. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, I mean, we both said, if you die, you better come back and speak to me. If that's possible, in whatever other realm you're in, let me know that you're there somewhere. We were both scared about being the one left alone, because when you're in this kind of a relationship and for such a length of time, it's very frightening to imagine being so bereft, and it's as bad as I thought it would be. But yeah, we had those kinds of conversations. And you'll remember in the book, Patrick at one point said, I think I might be dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I'm worried that that's what's happening too. And I read Patrick parts of this book while I was working on them, not the parts about his illness, but the parts about our past. I read him the sections about how we met and our cats and the time I killed the fish and all of those pieces, and he really enjoyed hearing them. And he'd say, oh, that isn't quite the way I remember it, or, yeah, you got that right, I think. So it was a delightful thing for us to share. And, he essentially gave me permission to write the book.
Yeah. The beginning of the book where you talk about how you met, even before you met, about how how poetry, I just love what you wrote. It said you wrote that it changed and charged your life.
Yeah.
What was your relationship to poetry before that? I mean, I guess you read it like we all did in school, right?
Yeah, and memorized it. Remember
memorizing
Alfred Lord Tennyson and Shakespeare's sonnets?
How painful that was,
Wordsworth. I actually liked it.
I actually loved
memorizing poetry, so that shows how weird I am, perhaps. So that was really my relationship to it. And then I became a high school teacher where I had to teach poetry, because I was taught in literature and composition. And so I was an avid reader, and it just suddenly worked its way into my bloodstream, I guess, so that I not only wanted to read it deeply and closely, I wanted to figure out how the great poets did it, and started to write very badly, you know, but learned from reading and going to summer school and, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
How, How would you know when it was good? Would you know that yourself, or would Patrick say as you were editing, tell you that it was good?
Yeah, usually a writer knows it. But you always think the thing you're working on at the moment is really good. But then you look at it 3 days later, and hopefully the inner editor has taken over by then and says, this isn't as good as you thought it was. You know, don't send it out tomorrow. Let it sit for sometimes a year or two and go back to it. And then it will speak its flaws to you as well as the parts that are working.
The other thing I was wondering about, because there are other animals, turtles and the sort, in your life. Why cats specifically?
Well, when we first, about 2 years after we were together, Patrick sensed that I needed something else in our lives. And he said, let's get a dog. And I said, no, because I've had dogs in the past, and I thought I got too close to them. And I warned him about that. So he said, well, let's get a cat then. You won't get as close to a cat. Ha, ha, ha. And because we traveled a lot, even in those early days, it's easier to have someone come and take care of your cat than it is for someone to come and take care of your dog. Mm. So we just, once we got our first cat, who we named after Alden Nolan, and we got him from the Regina SPCA. He was a wonderful cat. I was head over heels over cats from then on. I had just never had a nice cat in my life before. Mm. And so when Nolan died, we got another cat, and then another cat, and another cat. And we finally couldn't imagine our lives or our house or our garden without a feline spirit walking through it.
And the names were so precise, weren't they, even if you didn't know it at the time?
Yes, they were indeed. I mean, I really do believe that cats want to be named after poets, that they enjoy being named after poets. They have a lyrical grace to their muscles, to the way they leap in the air, to the way they move among the shadows. I think they're as musical as a poem is. They're a poem set into a muscular body, I think.
Finally, there's a section in the book that I've been thinking about ever since I put the book down. You ask, if we'd had children, would our feelings about each other have been less intense? And then you end that paragraph with, if we had children, ... Mm-hmm. At that point, are you asking a question or are you expressing regret?
I don't think I'm expressing regret, but I'm leaving the question hanging. I think it's impossible to answer, of course, because how can you know what influence something you didn't have would have on your relationship and your life? But it's a question. Would I feel less alone if we had had a child together? I'm lucky that Patrick's two sons who live in Victoria like me and want to see me, and so I get the advantage of having six grandchildren without having had a child. But I think it's different than having your own child, at least through my observing other people.
Now, he had five children in total.
Yeah.
Was that something, I mean, you guys talked about that, didn't you, when you started out together, right?
Yeah, first night we slept together, he said there'll be no children, because he had five. Yeah. And I thought it made total sense to him. Why would he need more? Also, he had left two families, and he bore the guilt of that all his life, really. So it wasn't something he looked forward to repeating. And for me, I really, you know, I don't know, maybe I really didn't want children, or I would have found someone else to have them with. Or the other answer is that our lives together gave me enough love and enough, I don't know, to say this is my life, and it's an alternative life, but it's one that I want to live. I sure don't have all the answers, Joe.
Yeah, it's one of those things that one thinks about.
Do you have children?
No, I don't. I'm single, 38.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting prodding from family about things like that.
I bet you are, yeah.
But I mean, it's
and
not.
And so do you imagine having children? Like, do you want
to? No, I probably would be a terrible parent.
Well, I might have been a terrible parent, too. But, I don't know. You know, who knows what our life holds for us, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's just so fascinating. I mean, I put the book down maybe 2 days ago. And, you know, I'm now at the point where I'm reading the book in the context of my own life, say. What did they do that say, I could do or I could avoid even?
Yeah.
So a million things come through your head, and then, you know, I'm thinking about the drinking. And I wish when I talked to Patrick all those times that I did, I asked him about it, say. But then, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I'll read his memoir.
Yeah.
And I can commune with him that way.
Yeah, that's lovely. I mean, that's the legacy he's left, is all those words, all those books of poetry, and his memoir. And, you know, once he stopped drinking, he never wanted to drink again. I think that's quite amazing and surprising.
Yeah.
It surprised him, and it surprised me. And after he stopped drinking, he was more productive. He said he couldn't have written novels,
right,
but he continued to be a drinker, for instance. So I think Canada got two really fine novels because of his sobriety.
And he was proud of those books, wasn't he? Red Dog,
really
Red Dog.
Proud of them. Yeah, really proud of them. Yeah, just the fact that he accomplished them.
Yeah.
You know, he said writing novels was a drudgery in many ways. You know, you write a poem and you spend 3 hours and you're done. I mean, you go back to it and back to it and back to it. But you write a novel and you've got to be in your office for 5 hours a day in front of your computer slamming out the words. And he would always make jokes about that. That, God, I prefer being a poet to a novelist.
The I want to end with this, Lorna. Words. I mean, that's your life, your work. What are the right words to say to someone like yourself, who's gone through what you've gone through these last 18 months, and who, I mean, we all say the wrong thing sometimes.
Yeah, it's really difficult, isn't it? Yeah, some people have said things that I have found really annoying.
Yeah.
Never use the word closure, for instance.
Right.
I think this will give you closure. I don't think there is ever any closure. I think the pain will always be there, but maybe I'll carry it more lightly. It's a tough one, Joe. I think just to say I'm really sorry to have heard that Patrick died is about all you can say. To say I'm sorry for your loss has become cliched now, hasn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
I prefer that people use the word death,
right,
the passing, or any of those euphemisms that we fall back on.
As I said at the start, I guess I didn't, I wanted to read the book. I didn't know that I would need it as I did.
Yeah.
And I, in that sense, I enjoyed it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've listened to the interview I did with Patrick the other night, and it was in the midst of all this. And I'm I don't know why it surprised me that you know, he was as thoughtful or cool, because he was always that way.
Yeah. I bet he was. That came through in the interview.
And he was
right?
So proud of the last novel as well, and the characters in it. And at one point he stops me and he says, I want to mention this other thing. And I mean, it just spoke to his generosity of these people that he knew, you know, 60, 70 years before.
Yeah, and you know, no one else could have written those novels. No one else had that working class experience in those brutal jobs, in those brutal mill towns, where again Patrick peeled his eyes back to see how women were mistreated,
mm-hmm.
how the natural world was raped in order to, you know, produce lumber that some company made a bunch of money from, but it sure wasn't the workers in the mill who had any kind of richness to their lives, either financial or otherwise. And he bore that experience of his young life forever. He always went back to it, you know.
Yeah. Lorna, I've kept this longer than I said I would, but it's delightful to talk to you, as it always is, but especially about this book, because it's an important one. It's a book that I think people should read, and so, congratulations on it. It's already done very well. and I'm sure we'll continue to do so. But I just, you know, I hope, I wish you the best.
Thank you so much. And you can cut this out of the interview you like, but what in the book do you think I should not have said?
I don't know. I mean, there are parts about sex and things like that that I'm probably...
Well, there aren't many parts
no.
about sex.
But there are parts that I wouldn't talk about. But that, I mean, I'm sheltered, I guess. Or
you're more discreet. Hey?
Probably.
We'll put it that way. I hope you're not sheltered. If you are, get on out there.
Yeah. But I just I love the candor of it. I mean, we have a mutual friend, and whenever I see Rhonda, I always ask about you, and so it's just fascinating to read. All those times that we would talk about how Patrick was or how you were.
Yeah.
This, I mean, I get a more fuller picture of what it was like.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And I couldn't have survived this this first year and a half without Rhonda.
Yeah. She's just one of the most thoughtful people I've ever met. I mean, she
organized Patrick's tribute, down to designing the program, finding the musician, at a point where I was just stumbling around in the dark, banging into walls. Rhonda just took over in the most generous and warm way, and because she'd studied with Patrick for so long and knew him well, she knew exactly what to do, you know?
Well, she's wonderful to me because I collect political buttons and things, and
she'd be perfect for that.
She's always finding things on the island that I would never find, and making sure I get them when she's on this side of the water. So,
isn't that wonderful?
I'm grateful to her, and I'm grateful for you taking the time to talk today. I appreciate this, Lorna.
Well, you always really read things carefully and closely, and I always enjoy your questions.
Visit lornacrozier.ca for more. The book is called Through the Garden, A Love Story with Cats. It is published by McClelland and Stewart. Lorna Crozier joined me on the line from Saanich, British Columbia, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.